Welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network's monthly podcast, available on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, various radio stations around the world. Find out where else on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. I'm Naomi Fowler. Email me on naomi@taxjustice.net if you want to subscribe or just say hello. Coming up this month, the latest shocking estimates on offshored wealth from poorer nations and emerging economies. Things could have been so different. But first, here's a quick dash through the Tax Justice headlines. My favourite story of the month, with criminal fines and settlements still stacking up against Swiss banks, $5 billion worth from the United States alone, and plenty more on the way, the Swiss government was planning to tweak a law that makes them tax deductible. But Swiss private bankers are up in arms about it. As long as no Swiss laws were broken, they argue, Swiss taxpayers should foot the bill for their misdemeanours in other countries. Of course, they stand to claw back millions from this. Here's the Tax Justice Network's John Christensen.
There is no good reason, economic or otherwise, for allowing tax deductibility on fines in other countries. And it's an absurdity which will only make the situation worse, because it doesn't discourage the crooked bankers from continuing with their crooked activities.
The Panama Papers scandal blew the lid off the offshore world and is still exposing the realities of corruption. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists worked closely with other journalists at the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, who first received the data. I'll be interviewing two of them in next month's podcast, by the way. The consortium also worked on LuxLeaks and SwissLeaks, among other stories. But speaking truth to power, serving the public interest, and rocking the world with offshore revelations isn't enough. Like much of the world's investigative media, even as one of the most successful reporting units, the consortium's struggling financially, moving out of its offices and laying off some staff to cut costs. An employee of the law firm at the centre of the Panama Papers scandal, by the way, Mossack Fonseca, has been arrested in Switzerland, accused of extracting confidential information, something the IT worker denies. The German newspaper who dealt with the source who leaked the Panama Papers data have said, according to their information, it's not John Doe. We'll keep an eye on that one. Another day, another dodgy tax deal. Microsoft agreed a secret deal with the British tax authorities to avoid a £100 million tax bill in the UK. The tax people have apparently struck 140 similar deals with other multinational companies that allow them to transfer profits made in Britain to accounts in other countries. In Microsoft's case, Ireland. Thanks, Ireland. And another gem from Microsoft this month, they're buying LinkedIn Corp for $26.2 billion. They've got enough cash to buy it four times over, but they're taking out a loan. Why? Yep, you've guessed it. They don't want to bring their offshored money mountain into the United States and pay tax on it. And this new debt means they'll be able to avoid paying around $9 billion in US taxes this year alone. Also in the United States, Los Angeles may introduce a millionaire's tax to help its 46,000 homeless residents. If the governor and state legislature approves it, the city's 120,000 millionaires will be required to pay 0.5% extra tax on their annual income. According to one poll, the policy has 76% support from LA voters. Those are the Tax Justice News headlines. Now it's over to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month we have got a very important referendum coming up in the British Isles. It's looking at this point, before we go to press, that Britain is going to come out of the European Union. What's really going on here behind the scenes?
Well, the important story behind Brexit is that clear links, which are not by and large disclosed, between some of the key players who are pushing for Britain's removal from the European Union and the City of London. Pushing for years, the funding comes out of the City of London itself. So what's the underlying motive, rather than the kind of superficial motives that are coming out in the press? One of the underlying motives is, of course, that the European Union is trying to strengthen and harmonise approaches to tax information exchange to roll back on tax evasion within Europe. And Britain is nominally going along with this, but is not prepared to give way on the role of trusts. And anybody who knows anything about tax evasion and tax avoidance by big companies and by individuals know that trusts play a key part. And they are particularly a key part of the British tax haven armoury. It's one of the key tools used by the British tax evasion industry. And Britain's fighting a rearguard action to block that. And the European Union doesn't want to make any concessions in that area. The second area where Britain has a conflict of interest, shall we say, with the European Union lies within the area of banking regulation. Since the financial crash in 2008, Britain has been lobbying very heavily, by which I mean both the City of London, the banking industry, but also senior government people have been lobbying very heavily within Brussels to block attempts to strengthen banking regulation. Nakedly, brazenly, they're pushing the City of London's deregulated criminal approach to finance. And the third area where, again, there's been a great deal of lobbying from leading politicians who are now closely associated with the Brexit campaign, people like Boris Johnson, lies with attempts to block the creation of a financial transaction tax within the European Union. And they've been very successful in lobbying within Brussels to ring-fence United Kingdom and City of London in particular from a financial transaction tax. So behind the scenes, clear financial sector interests trying to bully the European Union into making very heavy concessions to the British financial sector. And they're saying, well, you know, if we can't secure these concessions, then we're out of here.
We've heard talk of Britain becoming Britzerland, so kind of trying to take on a lot of the sort of complete finance domination of Switzerland and copy that kind of model even more than they already do.
I think Brexit will make it much easier for Britain to operate in isolation and take a lead in this race to the bottom on regulation and taxation. And that is clearly a key part of the development strategy of those who want to push for Brexit. Now, there's an extraordinary lack of coherence in their arguments, because on the one hand, publicly, they're saying Brexit is all about restoring national sovereignty. On the other hand, exactly the same cast of characters are pushing very heavily for TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which transfers sovereignty massively from the state to private corporations. I think all of this is part of an attempt by Britain to place itself as a key offshore financial centre, not just offshore Europe, but offshore the rest of the world, with very lax regulation and a deep secrecy provided by trusts and these offshore vehicles that Britain specialises in.
Okay. Let's move on and talk about a very interesting story that's come up in the Washington Post, which demonstrates just how offshore interests can come together to try and block meaningful transparency, financial transparency reform, whilst not really being very transparent themselves. And, you know, Panama Papers just keeps giving and giving, doesn't it? And this is, they came across an 8-page funding pitch where the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity was trying to hit on Mossack Fonseca in Panama for money.
Even before we launched Tax Justice Network in 2003, we knew about this secretive and very powerfully connected lobby organisation in Washington. The history goes back to 1997, when the G7 countries commissioned a report from the OECD to look at the role of tax havens and tax competition and how this was harming national sovereignty. And the OECD came forward with a very good report in 1998, which had already been watered down, by the way. And this tiny group, the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity, was created precisely to roll back against the OECD. And at one stage, they were linked up with some fairly sinister right-wing forces within Washington who were saying, well, if the OECD continues, we'll withdraw US funding support for the OECD itself. So they were using the time-honoured manner of bullying the OECD into submission. Now, we've known for a very long time, or rather we've suspected for a very long time, that the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity is funded by companies with links to tax havens, law firms with links to tax havens, and possibly by tax haven governments themselves. But there was no evidence to support our suspicions. In 2009, I asked the then director of the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity, because I met him at the Cato Institute. I went to interview him. His name's Dan Mitchell. I asked him to reveal their funding sources. And he refused to do this because he claimed that it's normal for not-for-profit organisations to not reveal who funds them. But I'm sorry, Daniel, that's not normal. It's normal for not-for-profits to reveal who funds them. Tax Justice Network is very, very clear about that point. Now, thanks to the Panama Papers, the truth is partially out. The Centre for Freedom and Prosperity is a corporate shill representing very powerful tax haven interests, and they've been approaching offshore companies like Mossack Fonseca asking for funding. It is not acceptable for lobbies in Washington or Brussels or anywhere else in the world to refuse to reveal their funding sources and to not be transparent about whose interests they represent. And elected politicians should quite simply refuse to even meet with lobbyists or advocacy groups who won't comply with that minimal level of transparency.
Yeah, exactly. And in this 8-page funding document, which came out through the Panama Papers, which the Washington Post found, they boast, that they've got allies and friends in over 50 countries, and they've had a major impact on the international tax competition debate. Nothing illegal going on there that we know of. They say they've not taken any money from foreign governments. But, this centre has been responsible for briefing prime ministers and presidents and finance ministers all over the Caribbean and in Latin America. They are connected with many, many different jurisdictions around the world, managing to hold back reform.
What they are doing is clearly anti-democratic. It's completely lacking in transparency. Very harmful to democracy. So there needs to be a global push to make organisations like the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity much more transparent, much more accountable, so that we don't find this constant abuse of not-for-profit status by, frankly, very sinister special interest groups.
And not only is it a question of politicians shouldn't really be talking to organisations that are not willing to be transparent about their funders, but the media shouldn't be interviewing people who are not transparent about where their funding is coming from. So, I mean, that's really unacceptable, I think.
I couldn't agree more. The media, I think, have been very lax in ensuring that organisations like that, which they have given, and the Centre for Freedom and Prosperity has had a voice in many media, particularly in the United States, over the last 15 years, and no one has questioned, who the heck are you? Who funds you? Whose interests are you pushing? And it's astonishing that politicians and the media have been willing to deal with such people.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. This month, we talk about the new estimates on the missing trillions offshored from 139 developing countries. It could have been such a different life for so many citizens living in poverty if it wasn't for the greed served by tax haven secrecy. The Panama Papers scandal tells us a lot about the offshore world and who uses it. It was the biggest leak in history so far, more than 11 million documents and plenty of dirt yet to be mined from them. But it's only the tip of the offshore iceberg.
We need to have international investigation of this kind of activity. It's time, really, kind of on a global level, to investigate the haven industry and to see, on a systematic level, what's going on. I think if we did that, I mean, the revelations from the Panama Papers have been sensational, but, you know, an international investigation with some kind of subpoena power would, I think, be 10 times as important.
I'm talking to the Tax Justice Network's Jim Henry, Columbia University professor, economist, asset recovery specialist and lawyer. Jim, before we go into the actual numbers of all this and your research, let's start with the process that's going on here, the enabler industry that's making it so easy for kleptocrats, the wealthy and the corrupt to get huge amounts of money out of the countries that need it so much.
Yeah, the first world has a major responsibility. The Panama Papers clearly shows that. Mossack Fonseca is this tiny Panamanian law firm with, you know, maybe 300 employees in Panama, 500 around the world, most of whom are not lawyers. They had one lady in Panama City who was a director of 26,000 companies, and she was earning, you know, like $10,800 a year. So she must be a phenomenal corporate expert. But, you know, they are basically order takers for kind of ready-made offshore companies and trusts. I mean, I call you up and I say, I'd like a company in the BVI. Okay, it's $1,200. When would you like it to have been formed? Would you like it backdated? How many directors do you want to have? And it's like that. And they weren't, you know, calling on President Putin or the Chinese president's family directly to get the business. You know, servicing more than 500 banks around the world, including some of the largest like HSBC that ordered 2,600 companies from Mossack, UBS and Credit Suisse ordered more than 1,000 each. So more than 500 banks and more than 14,000 law firms around the world that were issuing orders for this stuff and basically facilitating secrecy for their own clients. So this is a vast kind of global network. Basically, this whole kind of activity of offshoring is facilitated by enablers that are, you know, highly professional, sophisticated organizations that do this for a living and are doing it over and over again for many clients using many havens.
Right. And the point is, this money's ending up in the first world.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is to distinguish between offshore as a place and offshore as a conduit or as a capability. And the issue here is financial secrecy, whether it's provided by Delaware corporations or BVI companies or Jersey trusts. The ultimate investments are usually ending up in places with big capital markets like New York or big real estate markets like the City of London or Vancouver, I mean, is now seeing a real estate boom involving lots of Chinese money. New Zealand is seeing a similar thing. So the final destinations, I think it's important to emphasize for much of this capital, are really places with special tax benefits for offshore investors. That's often a case. Like the United States has a regime that allows foreign investors who are non-resident aliens to basically invest capital tax-free here. London has a similar sort of thing. UK has a similar arrangement for non-DOMs. So does Switzerland. So does most of Western Europe. So there is a tax aspect of this in terms of attracting this offshore money. But the real issue is the availability of secrecy, not the idea that the money is staying in the Cayman Islands or Panama or the Seychelles. It's actually ending up right next door. It's our banks and law firms and accounting firms and hedge funds and other intermediaries, corporate registries that are facilitating all this stuff.
Okay, two things in particular really stand out for me with your latest estimates and research. Firstly, that tax haven use, secrecy jurisdiction use, is on the increase, about 8 to 9% a year, which is depressing. And the other thing is the devastating effect of this offshoring from developing countries, the opportunity cost, the lost investment potential. So it's not just about lost tax revenue. It's actually much bigger than that.
Well, absolutely. And when you actually add up all this offshore flight wealth, we call it, most of that offshore wealth, not only the official reserves, but a lot of the flight wealth is invested in relatively low-risk assets, low-yield assets, because kleptocrats and many offshore investors are just looking for nest eggs. They're trying to protect a certain amount of money offshore for a rainy day or, you know, to have it when they get thrown out of office. Developing regions had about $8.7 trillion of official reserves, most of which are invested in first world assets like U.S. Treasury bills, earning, you know, less than 1% per year at today's market interest rates. So the opportunity cost to the developing world is enormous. Traditionally, we thought of developing countries as being net users, net borrowers, because they have higher returns on investment. And, you know, capital is scarce, and so they would be net borrowers. But this database stands that on its head. It really shows dramatically that they're basically financing us, the rest of us. And so since most of this money is not in places like Panama, it's actually invested back in the first world by way of offshore companies and trusts. It comes back to, you know, the US and the UK and Switzerland and other places that end up being the ultimate havens the question for the world economy is this the way we really want to proceed with development? There's something wrong when you have poor countries. Not all these countries are poor, but when you have developing regions like Africa, basically, for Africa, the flight wealth is about $710 billion. The official reserves are $183 billion. And on the other hand, the gross external debt for sub-Saharan Africa as of 2014 was $393 billion. So Africa is a net lender to the first world to the tune of about $500 billion. I mean, that's just outrageous. So we usually think in the tax justice movement, we talk a lot about the lost tax revenue to the offshore industry. Add to that the lost investment potential. Let's say that we had that $500 billion back and invested in Africa, earning 20% returns, because the social rate of return on investment in Africa is much higher than it is on U.S. Treasury bills.
Right, let's do some number crunching. Jim looked at 139 developing countries. To get these new estimates, he developed a methodology that uses figures compiled by bodies like the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, the CIA, and banks themselves on wealth siphoned out since 1970. He reckons a conservative estimate is $12.1 trillion for these countries. Countries, by the way, where many people are living in abject poverty. These developing regions owe $8.1 trillion of foreign debt. They've borrowed much of that from the United States and Europe. Over that same period, roughly that same amount of money was sent offshore. On top of that, corrupt leaders have stolen an estimated $4 trillion from the national treasuries they control. That must mean minimal to no due diligence on the origins of this money carried out by banks and law firms. And what about the global picture? Let's throw in hidden offshore wealth from rich nations, according to Jim's estimates. Then his global figure hits as much as $36 trillion offshored since 1970. In 2014, the net worth of planet Earth was about $240 trillion. Says Jim, that means about 15% of global wealth is in hiding. Jim, it's just too easy, isn't it, to siphon off massive amounts of money anonymously with impunity. The Panama Papers really showed that too, didn't they, quite graphically?
Yeah. More than 155 public officials with Panama Papers accounts, including 28 heads of state, kleptocracies around the world that are where public officials are basically kind of helping themselves to the treasury and putting it offshore undeclared. And we've always known that so-called financial secrecy havens or tax havens are at the center of a lot of tax dodging. But in this case, we find another whole kind of activity that's very important for developing countries, which is kleptocracy. And you see, sitting around the same basic financial secrecy facilities, you see the tax dodgers, the kleptocrats, the arms dealers, the drug dealers, and there's a lot of people engaged in financial fraud and financial chicanery as well, using these places. So it's not just fair to call this tax dodging. It's much broader than that. All kinds of illegal and some legal activities that ought to be illegal but are not turn up in this kind of investigation.
We've seen announcement after announcement, haven't we, from the leaders of wealthy nations. Let's take Britain's Prime Minister Cameron and the United States President Obama. As heads of two of the biggest global offshore players, they're really just tickling the belly of the problem, aren't they? I mean, this is a huge industry, and each little tweak just represents more consultation fees for the enabler industry, right? President Obama's just announced he wants to make people with a 25% stake in a US-registered anonymous shell company declare their identity.
Yeah. The president has offered a proposal that has a definition of beneficial ownership, which sets a very high bar for who's controlling or owning a company. It's 25% in his proposal, which would also have to go through Congress. I mean, and that faces a lot of opposition. But even his proposal, coming very late in the day in his administration, sets a 25% threshold for anyone who's to be considered a beneficial owner or has a notion of control. Well, the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for publicly traded companies requires beneficial ownership to be disclosed for anyone who owns more than 5% of a company. So it's not clear that the president really consulted with the SEC coming up with this proposal.
It's obvious how people would get around that anyway. They can just split it up into separate ownerships. It's just more fees for the lawyers, the banks, and the company formation agents, right?
Well, that's right. They're looking forward to this. It's easily avoided and it generates money. What's not to like? So
it's a new opportunity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we talk about this one Panamanian law firm. I mean, there's a corporate registry. There's three firms in Delaware that dominate that market. One of them has a third of the market. The owner of the company I interviewed said, well, you know, we're actually looking forward to beneficial ownership registration as a new cash cow. Because you just think every company has to come in and re-register with us. Is it another set of fees? And they'll have to do it, you know, like every so often.
Yeah, we know piecemeal solutions won't work. We've said that time and time again in the Tax Justice Network. We already know we need meaningful, enforceable, enforced across the board financial reform. You know, we need automatic information exchange, something the United States is resisting, public beneficial ownership registries, country by country reporting for multinational companies. And there's more than that if we were really serious, right?
Well, I think if we just rely on the technical stuff and we don't provide more investigative resources, we don't protect whistleblowers, we don't encourage whistleblowers, law enforcement doesn't get, you know, I mean, the IRS, for example, right now is starved for money to do simple audits. And if you think the U.S. IRS is starved, I mean, look around the developing world. I was in South Africa last fall studying this case where a major Wall Street bank had arranged for basically a raid on the South African treasury using an offshore scheme that generated phony tax credits for wealthy South African investors. This bank had set up a scheme that involved 13 different offshore companies, you know, in Caymans and Delaware and the Seychelles and Mauritius and Namibia. Virtually unauditable by the South African Treasury, unless they went to all these places. It took years. So that's just an example of what we're up against in combating this industry. It really will require us to take this to the next level. At the end of the day, I think the West has to stop, and you know, sort of the OECD developing world relationship has to improve. I mean, the two things that I would like to add to all the standard proposals that we make for cleaning this situation up. The first is we need to increase the penalties for those institutions and those professionals who facilitate the offshoring of wealth. And secondly, we need to have international investigation of this kind of activity. We need to end these havens, and the financial secrecy that they generate is just not serving anyone's interest.
And while we're waiting for reform and proper enforcement, you've got quite an interesting temporary solution, a controversial idea to start hitting these people for some kind of contribution to the world that they've been taking so much from, right, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think, hey, these people ought to be contributing something to the essential costs of running the world economy, the climate change costs and the continuing problems we have with disease and the immigration crisis, all of these collective costs that the world community is having to bear. And these folks are basically contributing nothing to those costs. So, hey, since the money tends to be pretty concentrated in maybe, you know, 30 destination havens, it ought to be possible for those countries, mainly OECD members, but also Switzerland and a handful of others, to get together and decide we will levy a tax on folks who decide to remain anonymous while we're waiting for the magic solutions. Of course, it'll face enormous opposition from the industry, and there'll be all kinds of arguments about how it's impossible. But, you know, our job is to make possible what we need to do. You know, that's why we have a tax justice movement. Make it happen.
You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. You can find Jim's research for Global Haven Industry Progress Report Quantifying Kleptocracy on www.taxjustice.net. We'll be back next month.